Hi there, I'm Jake Humphrey and you're listening to High Performance, our gift to you for free every single week. This podcast reminds you that it's within your ambition, your purpose, your story. It's all within. We just help you unlock it by turning the lived experiences of the planet's highest performers into your life lessons. So right now, allow myself and Professor Damien Hughes, an expert in high-performing cultures, to speak to the greatest leaders, thinkers, sports stars, entrepreneurs, and artists on the planet so they can be your teacher. Remember, please, this podcast is not about high achievement or high success. It's about high happiness, high self-worth, and taking you closer to a life of fulfillment, empathy, and understanding. And on that note, before we go any further, everyone on the High Performance Podcast would like to send their love and congratulations to Dame Kelly Holmes, who came out as gay in the last few days. And Dame Kelly actually joined us on High Performance. She was one of the very first people to say yes to the emails that we were sending out asking people if they would come and, you know, be a guest on this strange new podcast journey that we found ourselves on. And she was honest, she was disarming, she spoke about things that I'd never heard her speak about before. And it's been an incredible journey, her life. So if you want to hear what Dame Kelly Holmes said to us on the High Performance Podcast, episode 10 is where you need to head to. But on behalf of all of us, and I know it was a big moment for Dame Kelly Holmes, and following in the footsteps of Jake Daniels and other high-profile sports people as well, it's fantastic that this conversation about people's sexuality is being discussed. And people feel now in 2022 that the world is a world where they can openly say, I'm gay, and they'll be accepted. So Dame Kelly, congratulations from all of us. Now on to today's episode. This is what's in store for you.
This time, one of the many chats that we had just before he passed away, probably the last coherent conversation I had with him, I was about to leave. I said, Dad, I better go now. It's getting late. And he said, no, all right, sonny. And as I went, he went, I love you. And it was like, whoa. And I went, love you too, Dad. And I got out and I got in the lift and I was gone. Believe you me, by the way, I wasn't the only one that was in awe of Diego Maradona. When he walked in, everyone was like, tongues were hanging out. I mean, he had that much of a presence. He was that much better than everyone else. I just can't really comprehend how you cannot have a degree of empathy towards people having to flee their own country, which is an unimaginable thing to have to do. I mean, you imagine if suddenly London was completely bombed like we're seeing in Ukraine now and we all had to go. I think you've got to think like that a little bit. So I've always been, you know, on that side of things. And anyone who wants to have a pop at me about that, I don't think they're worth the time of day.
Do you remember when I joined BT and I wrote that blog about we're going to have new pundits fresh from the game? And you took offence to that and you messaged me and said you've offended people with a lifetime in the game.
Well, yeah. I wish I hadn't really got involved with the Brexit thing.
Really?
To be honest. I don't mind admitting, you know, not the sense of putting out that I was going to vote for Remain, because I don't mind putting out what I do. But the thing afterwards and then getting a bit carried away with the fact that we lost, and I think if I had my time again, I wouldn't have bothered with that.
Now, this is an interesting one for me because obviously I've worked very closely alongside Gary Lineker for well over 10 years, both at the BBC and at BT Sport. And to be honest, I would say that I didn't feel I knew Gary very well, actually. You know, we've done a lot of work together, and I guess there is a certain professional, is it a rivalry? Maybe there is a professional rivalry there because we both do similar jobs. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I actually think it's really healthy. But I don't think we know each other particularly well, actually. And I was really glad to have this conversation because there's a few little moments that we've had over the years. I remember writing a blog when I joined BT Sport. Gary took exception to it and I was surprised by that. And obviously he didn't like what I'd done. There's been a couple of occasions where he's also done things and I've thought, that's slightly strange. I wonder why he's done that. And it was really good for us actually to have this conversation. You know, as many of you know, one of the biggest issues I have at the moment and why I'm not really on Twitter too much is because everyone feels they have to have an opinion about everything. And it's like the world will still revolve without you sharing your opinion. And we speak to Gary about that and his answers are fascinating. And as you've just heard in that small teaser we've just played, you know, he talks really openly about his relationship with social media, why it's powerful for him, why he does it. And what you have to remember, right, this is a guy who's got to the absolute top of his game in football and then transferred across to broadcasting and got to the top of his game in broadcasting. And that is such a hard thing to do. It isn't celebrated enough. It isn't spoken about enough. And, you know, just a few days before this podcast was released, you know, Gary shared some stuff on social media about global warming and everyone just came for him. And it's like, guys, let's have less opinion and let's have more empathy. And I'm so pleased we had this conversation. I think you're really going to enjoy it. Gary, thank you so much for coming on and speaking to us. Don't forget, you can watch as well as listen to this. All you need to do is head to YouTube, type in High Performance, and you can watch this episode. So I really hope that you do watch this on YouTube as well as listen to it right here, wherever you get your podcasts. And before we get going with today's episode, I just want to say welcome back to Lotus Cars. You know, when we first started the High Performance Podcast, I was just a guy making some television programs, wanting to share these kinds of conversations. I genuinely had no idea whether people would like them, whether people would listen, whether it would have an impact. But Lotus were the very first people when I sent around a load of emails saying, does anybody want to help me with this new idea I've got for a podcast about mindset? Lotus, well, the business said, you know what? We trust you on this, Jake. Give it a go. And I'm so pleased that they're back involved with us on High Performance as well. If you're listening to this on Monday and you're in the UK, you would have seen the fantastic review that the Lotus Emira got last night. Brilliant, brilliant review on Top Gear. Chris Harris drove the car. It's such an exciting time for Lotus Cars. If you want to know what they're up to and if you want to know why their future is electric, then just go to lotuscars.com. But I think the fact they were the very first people to stand alongside the High Performance Podcast and help us make our dream a reality is a good insight into the kind of high performance people that are running Lotus Cars. Love you, Lotus. Welcome back to the podcast. Let's do it then. Gary Lineker on High Performance comes next.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Well, Gary, thank you so much for coming and chatting with us today.
Pleasure.
Let's start then, as we always do. What is, in your opinion, high performance?
Achieving, I suppose. And I think high performance, personally, is if you can perhaps overachieve and do better than perhaps people would expect, although I always think your own expectations are far more important than other people's expectations of you. Being successful and ultimately being happy with your levels of success. I think a sustained high performance is also consistency related. So I think that's important to do it over a long period of time.
Of all of those things, are you most proud of the fact that you have had consistency, whether it was in your football career or in your broadcasting career?
Yes, possibly. I think that's probably fair. I think what happens is I've been fortunate enough to do pretty well in two different spheres, although they're both obviously related because they're both, you know, the one consistent in my entire lifetime is football. So they're both related around football. But I think you know, people often say, "What, you know, what were you better at and stuff like that?" But I think I always say I was born to be in the box, and I kind of learned how to be on the box. And I'll end up in a box not long off. I've been around that long, but I'm kind of proud of the longevity I've had in football, and proud that I made something happen in terms of television that I probably wasn't a natural at it, certainly not at the start. So I had to, you know, football kind of came easy. I knew what I was doing. It was just, you know, obviously you still have to work hard and give it everything, but it was, it, you know, had some kind of gift. Whereas TV wise, I understand the sport and I understand football, but I didn't understand television. So I think that the longevity I've had in TV makes me perhaps prouder in a way, because it was harder.
Mm. So can you tell us about your early life then, Gary, growing up in Leicester? Mm. We just spoke off camera about
it.
We spoke there about your dad being a market trader, yeah. And that's not an easy job. You know, it's long hours, early starts, etc. And you've just referenced the importance of hard work. What other kind of lessons were you picking up at that young age that have still continued to serve you well?
It's difficult to remember, you know, that much of my childhood. Most of it was playing football. But I think in terms of work ethic, that came from my dad. I mean, he lived life as well. And he would, you know, he'd get up at 3-4 in the morning. He'd go to the wholesale market in Leicester to buy all his produce. He'd then go to the market stall. I mean, Leicester's a, you know, famous outdoor market. I think at one time it may still be the biggest outdoor market in Europe. And he used to, you know, then he'd go to the stall, he'd set all his stuff up, put all the, you know, the oranges, the apples, the strawberries, the bananas, whatever it is. And, you know, and then he'd be serving customers all day. He'd get home, I don't know, 6:30 in the evening. He'd do his paperwork before, and he'd have some dinner, and then he'd fall asleep on the couch. He'd have a day off a week, and he'd play cards for 24 hours solid, drinking whiskey and stuff. But he's, you know, he worked all hours, and I mean, it was hard. I mean, especially, you know, winter when it's freezing cold, it's outside. And I think what it did do for me, though, was make me more determined to be good at football, because I didn't really want to follow in his footsteps to escape it, subconsciously, I think. But yeah, I learned a lot of lessons from my father. My mother was kind of, she was very calm. That's where I get my personality from, the fact that I'm very kind of stable. I don't get too carried away, neither up nor down, very easygoing. I don't have a temper. I never saw my mum lose her temper either.
Right.
Whereas my brother's more like my dad.
So you said you learned a lot from your dad. What would you describe as the key things you learned from him?
Well, people often talk about my kind of, the fact that I never got booked. I never got a yellow card or a red card in my whole career. And I go back to it. I remember one incident that I remember really well is that I was playing a game. I must have been about 14 at the time. And I was scoring a lot of goals by that stage. And I think the referee gave two or three decisions that I didn't agree with, and I swore at the ref. And I, you know, and my dad walked onto the pitch, grabbed me by the scruff of the neck, and said, "Right, you ever do that again, you will not play football." And he took me off the pitch.
In front of all your mates.
In front of all my mates. It was like, whoa.
And was your dad a coach, or was he just
observing? No, he was just a parent. He said, You don't talk to referees, you don't talk to anybody like that. And just scruff of the neck, boom, in the van, home. He wasn't a coach, but he used to take the team around, and we always sit in the back of the van, all wobbling all over the place, the whole team.
And how would you describe your relationship with him? I was quite moved when I heard you say on another podcast that the only time he said, "I love you," was as he was dying.
Just before. It was, and we were always very close. He would say that he was proud, you know, occasionally. And I know that he got a lot of pleasure out of watching me play in particular, which was important. And it's true. I mean, he ended up getting lung cancer, which wasn't overly surprising that he'd get that, because he used to smoke about 60 to 80 a day of those things without any tips on. So it was, you know, it wasn't that surprising, but, and he was, he's kind of phlegmatic about it. But I used to go up to Leicester and particularly towards the latter stages, I was up there every other day. I get a call and we're not sure he's going to, so up I go and then back down to, so I was up and down. And in that time, we had to have more kind of meaningful conversations than we probably ever had in our life, because everything before was just fun and like banter or whatever you want to call it. And then we had these, conversations. And one of them was, when my parents were, when I was at school, when I was, obviously 10 years old, because I passed the 11 plus. But we just moved to a house in a place called Kirby Muxlow, which was outside the centre. So it was in the county. So when I passed the 11 plus, there was only one school that you could choose from. There's only one grammar school in that particular area. But they didn't play football there. So my dad said, we can't have that. He said, that happened to me when I was young. He said, I'm not going to allow that to happen to you. So he said, we'll move. So I said, oh, right, fine. I went to live with my grandparents for 6 months to enable me to go to what was then City of Leicester Boys Grammar School. It's obviously no grammar schools around now. Got to be a certain age to remember the 11 plus. So I lived with my grandparents for 6 months, and I remember having a conversation with them. I said, Dad, that was a hell of a thing to do. I was like 10 years old. What, you must have... I remember him saying, he said, he said, I couldn't let that happen to you. And he said, I could see your talent. I said, did you know that I was going to be, because I never did. Even when I was 22, 23, 24, I always thought I was blagging it. And my dad said, I always knew. And I said, well, you could have told me. And it was like that. And then this time, with one of the many chats that we had just before he passed away, probably the last coherent conversation I had with him. I was about to leave. I said, Dad, I better go now. It's getting late. And he said, no, all right, sonny. And as I went, he went, I love you. And it was like, whoa.
Yeah.
And I went, love you too, Dad. And I got out and I got in the lift and I was gone. I was crying. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, like eight nurses and people came in the lift. And it was like,
oh, no.
Are you all right? Yeah, I'm all right. I'm sure they used to see people crying in hospitals. But it was moving. It meant a lot. Because, that generation, they didn't share their feelings very much. I think it's changed now. I'm totally different, my kids, than that. But it's just how it was.
And how much of that young life then was about trying to impress your dad or trying to get that nod of approval from him?
Probably a lot of it, really. I think most of us, we look up to our parents, and then eventually when we get adults, we work out that they've got weaknesses and foibles as well. Absolutely. I'd always want to impress, my dad. My mum used to come and watch, my granddad as well. My granddad played for the army for the British Army. It's kind of it's just before the war or even during it, I think. He was a really good footballer. So that's probably where I get certainly the speed from, because he was rapid. I think you all want to please your parents. And I was always the same, even when I was a professional.
See, one of the things that stood out when I was reading about your young life as well, Gary, was just the variety of sports that you did as well. So you were a good level cricketer. You were a really good snooker player as well. How important do you think that variety of doing different sports rather than just focusing solely on football was for your eventual career?
It's hard to know because that's how I did it. So I've got nothing to compare it with. But I don't think it's that uncommon for someone who reaches the high level of sporting excellence to be good at other sports, because obviously there's a certain hand-eye coordination, those kind of things, certainly spatial awareness, that sort of stuff. I always thought I'd make it cricket, not football,
right, when
I was a kid. I mean, I was very small. I didn't reach puberty till I was 17, which was embarrassing at times in the shower when I joined Leicester, but I used to hide and sneak in the little shower at the end. So I didn't really grow until I was, which is, I think, why I was a slow to reach the top in football. So I wasn't like, Michael Owen or Wayne Rooney or many of the young players we see today that emerged in their teens. I was 20, 21 before I started to become a regular at Leicester. In cricket, I honestly believe I'll make it at cricket. I captained Leicestershire schools right through. Yeah. I played in the England Schools Festival.
But did you ever reach a moment where you had to make that decision then?
I suppose so, but not really, because football's opportunity just came along. I think I was about 12 years old when I got spotted, and I used to go Tuesdays and Thursdays after school and then Saturday mornings if we didn't have a school match, to training at Leicester, at what would be called an academy nowadays. And then I had trials when I was 16, and they said, we're going to take you on as an apprentice. And then cricket took a back seat, really. That was it. So it was just the opportunity that came along first was the one I've got no regrets about that.
And we have lots of teachers and lots of parents that listen to this podcast. What advice would you give to parents of talented youngsters or teachers who are looking to get the best out of their young people to really empower them but not overawe them?
Just encourage them, really. I think that's what I go. I mean, one of my pet hates in life was watching my, not because I was watching my boys play football or cricket or rugby, whatever it was they were playing, with the parents on the touchlines or even the coaches at times, because everything's so negative. Don't mess about with it there, boot it, go over there. And you just thought, no, you know, and these kids just want to have fun. And if they've got talent, if you're too critical of them, you'll knock it out of them. You're either not the love of the passion of the game, so therefore they won't play anymore, or you're not their confidence, so they won't perform as well as they possibly could. I watched my four boys all play, all different levels. You know, George, my eldest, by his own admittance, he wasn't very good. In fact, summing up parents, I had one woman come up to me, a mother of one of the players. She said, is that your lad up front there, isn't it? I went, yeah, that's George. She went, well, I thought it'd be better than that. So it's, you know, you get that kind of nonsense on touchline. Yeah. Everything's like negative. So, you know, the advice I would always give them is just to be positive. I just sat usually on the side of the touchlines watching them for years and years and years, never said a word. I'd clap if they did well and then when after the game I'd say, oh, you did really well. Just encouragement.
And how much of a challenge was it being an elite performer and being a parent at the same time? We have a lot of messages from people saying, I want to give 100% to my family life. I want to give 100% to my career. I'm not sure how and what to do.
Well, I think the fortunate thing about being a footballer or even involved in football in the way I am now is that, as you will know yourself, I mean, doing the similar job, is that even though you do work hard, there's a nice balance to the life. There's a lot of home time. And I think that was important. It's not like you'd work in every day.
Yeah.
So there is a nice balance. And I feel blessed at that because I've watched my kids grow up and spent a lot of time with them in that process.
Can we talk about when the football career started then? And you ended up at Leicester and Jock Wallace was the man in charge. What did that period teach you?
Jock was great for me.
Yeah.
I mean, I tactically it was, you know, from a bygone age and it was, you know, long ball but you know, up and at him stuff. But he's a hugely significant person in my career. Not necessarily for my football, but for how to live my life outside of football and how to give myself the best possible chance to succeed. He was a terrifying individual. He came down when I was, I think, about 17, 18, and I was starting to make a bit of progress. And the first time I ever saw him was, he got the manager's job on a Tuesday, and then we had a Wednesday night reserve game at Filbert Street. And we playing the game, and it came in at half-time, and then Jock came in at half time and this huge imposing figure, and he walked through the door and he was cursing you. We have beaten you, useless little. And I was thinking, woof. And he was looking at me and he walked up to me and he picked me up behind the scruff of the neck, put me against the dressing room wall. He's going, don't you get running, you wee lazy English little shite, you, all this stuff. And I was going, I was terrible. I wouldn't have minded, but I'd scored two goals in the first half. We were 2-0 up. And then, needless to say, I didn't do much in the second half. I was a gibbering wreck. And then at the end of the game, he came in again and he went, my office, 9 o'clock in the morning. No. Forgive me for the terrible just Scottish accent.
It's not bad.
So he said, so I thought that was it. I thought my career was gone. I thought I was finished. But I got there about 8:45 and I sat outside his office like a naughty boy waiting to see the headmaster. And eventually, 15 minutes or so later, he said, "Laddie, go in, sit down." So I sat down like this, and he says, and I was trembling. And he just said, "Oh, I want to say one thing."
You actually were trembling?
I was trembling. I was definitely trembling, terrified. Thought I was going to be shown the door.
Yeah.
And he said, "I just want to say one thing. You were magnificent last night." I said, "I beg your pardon." "You were magnificent," he said, "but I just wanted to make a wee point, Laddie, that you've always got to give a little bit more. Let that be a lesson in life." And I thought, "Oh my God."
Wow.
I thought, "You could have told me last night." But, and then he became very much, not a father figure, because that's because I had a father figure, but he became important because he'd lecture me about how to, you know, "You don't go out drinking after a game and after tonight. Don't go, you know, you'll have your times when it's the right moment after a Saturday game." And he said, "You've got a chance." And I still went out occasionally, but I wasn't like so many of the others that will go and drinking pints and all this all night and going out and stuff. So I think that was important because he got and helped me to understand how to get, as a sportsman anyway, how to get the best out of myself.
But I was going to ask, Kerry, like, how does, like, a grammar school lad going from the environment, like what you had at school and in the cricket environment, to going into that where resilience is almost expected of you, how did you learn to cope in that environment then?
That's a good question, but it's a difficult question to answer because I don't honestly know. I mean, you're right. And, you know, I talked about jokingly about, you know, I hadn't reached puberty and I'm walking in the shower, and I was genuinely, you know, because you don't want to show any kind of weakness and stuff like that. So, and it, you know, it was tough. And I, in those days, it was an apprenticeship. So you, half the time you'd be spending either cleaning dressing room, or cleaning players' boots. I mean, I had the job of the first team dressing room, which was good, but it was also tough because, you know, some of my heroes were there, and I'm, you know, Frank Worthington was there for a few months at some point, and, you know, Mark Wallington, the Leicester goalkeeper, and so many, you know, of the people and players that I'd kind of worshipped as well. And I was there cleaning up the dressing room, and it was, you know, they treat you. And the thing is, now it seems ridiculous, but nowadays every team, they have like a million kits, don't they? Fresh kit every day, new shiny boots. In those days, they got one set of kit for the season, for training. So what we did on the Monday, I trained, they finished the training, whatever, you know, either sweaty or stinky or freezing or covered in mud. And then we used to have to put it on these hangers and then take them all into the drying room, and they just dry overnight. So you can imagine the stench by Thursday and Friday. And then we had to, you know, you had to kind of wipe the dressing room floors and, you know, mop them and clean the toilets and do all these kind of jobs, which I did until I was 18. And then again, it gave you a thing about, I really need to make it a football.
But did you ever have a back door, like the idea that, actually, I'll go and give cricket a go.
Well, I honestly thought if it didn't happen, I carried on playing. I always played right throughout, you know, when I was footballing, I played right throughout my career. And I played one Thursday, which I never normally do. But I used to play when I was playing for Tottenham, I used to live in St John's Wood. So I used to play for a club called Cross Arrows, who play pretty much every day in September. It's like a chat. Right. And for me, that was perfect because they'd play on a Tuesday or Monday or whatever. So I could fit it in around if I got a free week. And then I played on this Thursday one day, which I wouldn't normally do when we got a game on a Saturday. But so I went and played in the afternoon after training, and I got a few runs, and then we fielded, and they said, "Come on, Gary, have a bowl." And I said, "I don't bowl. I don't want to bowl." Because the game was kind of meandering to a draw. So I don't want to bowl. I don't bowl. They said, "Go on, have a go." And I went, "All right." So I came in. The second ball went like that, and my side went twang. I thought, "Oh, no." And I was struggling. And I went in training the next morning. I think we were playing Villa on the Saturday. And I came in and said, "I've got to go and see Terry Venables." And I said, "Terry." And he went, "What have you done?" And he said, "I've torn my side." He said, "How'd you do that?" And I thought, "Do I lie?" And I thought, no. I said, I did it playing cricket. He said, you did what? He said, that's it. No more cricket. No more cricket. I said, you can't. I said, no. I said, no more bowling, Terry. No. And we came to a deal on no more bowling. So I always played. In fact, my favourite, you can forget all the World Cups and all that. Well, probably one of my favourite days ever. It was a Monday and it was the week before the start of the new season. And we had a friendly at White Hart Lane in the evening. I think it was against West Ham. Not sure. And
wouldn't be much of a friendly then, would it?
No, but yeah, but it was just a warm-up game, you know, so it doesn't matter. But anyway, so on the night before, on the Sunday, I get a phone call from a guy called Dave English, who ran the Bunburys, which was a charity cricket club. But he also organised a lot of testimonial cricket games for players. He did a lot of good, wonderful guy. He said, I've got a game tomorrow, great game at Finchley, just up the road from you. He said, can you play? I said, I can't play tomorrow. So I've got a game. So I've got a game. I said, I can't. I'd love to play. He went, oh, we've got so many players like this and that. He's playing this. And I said, I can't. I said, I can't. I'd love to. He said, what about if you bat first, you can open. When you're out, you can go. He said, I just need a name. I need another celebrity name. I went, Christ, go on then. So I went along. And the first over bowling was Courtney Walsh, right? So I'm there. And he does this. He goes off this ridiculous long run up and then like comically bounces it miles over my head as a joke. And then the next ball, he goes off for about a 3-yard run and he's going to bowl. And I went, Courtney, I said, would you give us a proper over? You know, like a proper foot. And he went, you sure, man? I went, yes. So I thought, go on then. So he goes on his normal run. He comes down. And the first ball, it was like, oh, Christ, he went past the bat before I even see it. Second one, it was similar. He was sensible. He was kind of bowling it just full length and outside the off stump. Yeah. He didn't want to hurt. So second ball, I'd left. And then I got a couple of forward. On the last ball of the over, I just thought, well, he's pitching it there. I'll take a bit. And I put a front leg and I stroked it. And he went right through the covers for four. And it was like, whoa. So it was one of those days where I just couldn't miss. I ended up 112 not out at lunch. Sweating.
No.
112 not out at lunch. I was thinking, and I said, Dave, I got to go. He said, no, go on. You've done me proud. Off you go. So I went off and played that night and scored a hat-trick.
Yes, what a day.
That's the best day
that
ever.
That is a high-performance
day. Forget the World Cup. That was a high-performance day.
Did you buy a lottery ticket the way home
I just
well.
Should have done, yeah. It was amazing.
There is an interesting recurring theme, though, isn't there, when we look back over all that period, whether it is your dad pulling you off the football field in front of your mates, whether it is hiding in the shower at the end because you were a late developer, whether it is Jock making you shiver in his office with panic, all of that is resilience building. Mm. And I wonder whether we create resilient enough young people these days. You know, Damien and I talk often about our frustration with helicopter parenting, where we're all addicted to hovering over our children, smoothing everything in front of them. And all of those are really good lessons that the struggles and the failures and the low points and the hard times were the bits that created you.
Mm. It's hard to know, isn't it? Because there's no kind of guidebook, is there, for parenting when you just get this little thing, don't you, and off you go. So it's a really hard one. I don't know. And I often, you know, I often think about why have I been so successful? I genuinely think many, many times, why have I been so lucky? You know, I always think sometimes, because I'm not religious, I don't mind admitting I'm an atheist, I don't believe any of that stuff. But I do wonder sometimes whether there's some other planet out there, whether they're playing a PlayStation game or something, and we're just part of their game. And whoever I've got has been a really good player and has given me one hell of a life. You know, I do wonder why. Obviously I was given a gift to play football and I had a good work ethic, but so many things have happened to, you know, like I didn't get injured. I didn't, you know, at all. Until the very end of my career. So I had so much good fortune. I think it's always important to
understand. Did you feel lucky that. Even as a young man? Did you feel that sense of fortune? Or was it more in hindsight?
I was kind of, without being good at sport, life would have been very different for me because I was, you know, I think I would have been bullied at school. They were kind of marginally that way anyway because I was like, you know, this tiny geeky kid with like, darkish skin and I pretty much racist abuse, although I'm not, I'm as English as they come.
Really?
Yeah, all the time. even in professional football, I had that a couple of times. I wouldn't ever name any names. Yeah. So I got that kind of nonsense, which was a bit weird. But, you know, whether that was part of something that made me, I don't know. But other people might not be able to handle that. But I think by, you know, my greatest strength to me, was not, you know, not my right foot, not my this. It was my mental strength. And I always had that. I was never nothing, you know, even if I had a shocking game or things were not going very well,
yeah.
It never really got to me.
So even if we fast forward a bit into your career in that build up to 1986, when you're in the team, but you haven't scored for a while, there's lots of media speculation as to whether you deserve your place. Mm. How were you processing all of that you're in? Like, I've seen the documentaries where it wasn't like the hotel rooms in Mexico were quite austere. You've not got the ability to phone home easily.
Yeah, it's what you're used to. I mean, football changed dramatically. Yeah. And it was very different back then. But it's so much how it is and how it was that was, you just got on with it.
But the bit about you personally is a bit that I'm interested in, of how did you cope with that pressure that you'd injured your arm, there was a speculation about your role.
Oh, for that particular thing, well, I thought my World Cup was done, you know, but they managed to find this sprint that they would have, it was right to the last minute, they were trying different sprints on and stuff. And in the end, I had this one that was fairly useless, but it meant I could play.
Yeah.
I mean, I was in so much pain in 86, the whole, just running, the wind against my hand when I was running was absolutely agony, let alone when falling over and stuff. But I was so determined to play. I mean, it's the World Cup, you do everything.
But how did you block out the noise about, like, whether you were good enough to be there or the speculation around you?
Again, I had my self-doubts all the time. You know, I hear people say, you know, I always knew I was going to, and I didn't. I genuinely, even after the World Cup, you know, when I was 16, 17, breaking through at Leicester, I remember first time I was in the reserve team, I used to think, this will find me out. And then I got in the first team, and I was sitting around all these, my heroes, and thinking, what am I doing in here? And then, you know, I struggled for a bit because I was, as I said, small, and, you know, and I didn't really break into it till I was 20, 21. Then I started scoring a lot of goals. And then I got an England call-up. I was at home one Monday afternoon, just got home from training, and the phone rang, and my mum answered it. And she said, this when the old days of a landline, remember them? So she answered it, and she said, it's Gordon Milne, who was the then Leicester manager, was after Jock Willis. I went, what? I thought, oh God, what have I done? Because I'd never had a phone call ever from a manager. So I've gone to the phone, I've gone, boss? And he's gone, grab yourself a toothbrush, come to the ground, pick up your football boots, drive up to Wrexham. Bobby Robson's been on the phone. You're in the England squad. So that's what I did. I did exactly that. And I always remember driving up. And it was so embarrassing. I just have this little sponsored like car with my name all written over the side of it. I remember because so I drove up all the way to Wrexham because we were playing Wales. And I arrived there and I remember seeing like Tony Woodcock, Pete Shilton, all these Terry Bush, all these players that I was like...
Well, they would have been your heroes, right?
Well, definitely. I mean, I was 24 by the time I got to England, but I was still, as I said, I always think I was a little bit behind in terms of my maturity, probably because of the reasons I talked about before, but, you know, I just think, what? Anyway, I didn't get on that game, but then I think it's about a year later that I actually made my debut and scored my debut, full start, I should say. I played 10 minutes at Hampden. And then I started scoring goals with England. It just didn't seem to make any difference which level that I'd still score. I enjoyed it. I just went out and just played and did my job. And I didn't get nerves. I don't get nerves. I don't know. I'd hear people talk about that feeling of like nervous tension or butterflies. And I don't know what that feels like. So
for anything, never had it for
no.
any.
Really? No. You know, and then I went to the World Cup and I scored 6 goals and I won the Golden Boot. And then I went back and then suddenly I'm playing for Barcelona.
Yeah.
And then in my first Clásico, which is January, I scored a hat-trick in it at home. We win 3-2. And then a month later, I scored 4 goals against Spain in Bernabeu. And I genuinely thought I was blagging it. And I remember running back to the halfway line And Brian Robson's alongside me, and I went, Robbo. And he went, what? Why am I so lucky? And he went, oh, do fuck off.
But you didn't feel that.
But that was it. And then it was at that point that I started to realise, actually, no, I'm good at this. I am genuinely good
at
this.
And what age were you then?
I'd have been 26.
So 25, did you 26? Not have an ego? You didn't barrel around.
I think we've all got an ego. It was just,
but not...
I hope not. I was confident. Once I'd got to that stage, once I was at Barcelona and doing all these things, then I think there was more confidence came into my game. But it's weird to try and explain to people, because I don't think you can get to the very top of something by not really believing in yourself. And I did believe in myself, but I didn't see myself on the same level as the other great players in world football.
But maybe that was actually a brilliant strength, because it meant you were never comfortable. You were constantly challenging yourself.
Constantly challenging yourself, constantly pushing myself to do more. I was never satisfied with anything. In fact, it was always like, oh, you probably just got away with that. I don't know. It's weird, and it's really difficult to explain, and it's probably not the greatest advice, but that's how I was. And I've always been
Do you remember that game when there was a centenary match at Wembley and you were on that rest of the world team, and you had people like Maradona,
Diego
all the greats of the game. What were you thinking when you were in that dressing room at that stage? Had you accepted that you deserved to be
around
there?
This period, it was the Football League centenary. So it was the English league playing against the rest of the world.
Yeah.
So it was a friendly, but it was, and I was playing for the rest of the world because I was at Barcelona at the time and not part of the Football League. But believe you me, by the way, I wasn't the only one that was in awe of Diego Maradona. When he walked in, everyone was like, tongues were hanging out.
Really?
I mean, he had that much of a presence. He was that much better than everyone else. And Platini played in that game, and there was like all sorts of great players. And he just walked in. And he was the only one that was paid to play in that game, quite a lot. But did we care? No. And he came in, and the first thing he did, he just sat there. He got changed to his shorts. And then he just, you get a pair of socks and you roll them, and he just juggled it on his left foot for about 2 minutes, 3 minutes. And then he walked out and did this thing that kicked the ball up in the air. He was just on another level. And for me, what is unbelievable is that you can play at the highest level of sport like I've managed to do, and like lots of those other players to do. But then there can be someone that is that much better than everyone else still. Mm. That kind of genius. It's like Messi in the last 15 years. He's just does things that ordinary mortals can't do. Just can't. But that was magical. That was magical. I'd see that.
So when did you develop these superstitions that you have?
I had loads of those when I was young.
Yeah. So
do you know what I worked out though in the end? Being superstitious is unlucky.
But were they coping strategies that you think maybe substituted
not deliberately, for nerves? But yes, I think they were.
Yeah,
I think they were. It's all about because it's about confidence and calmness and being. Because my main worry before I played in the game, the only thing that I used to worry a little bit about was how I would feel physically once the game started.
Right.
Because it's amazing how different. You can get out on the pitch and suddenly you feel, oh, everything's hard work, everything's aching, or, it's the same now when I go in the gym. I go in the gym 3 days a week. Two of the days I might feel great, and then one day I feel awful. And as I get older now, it's 2 days that I feel awful and one day that I feel great. But the important thing is that you're comfortable and confident yourself. So if I was on a bad run, I'd do like silly things. Like if I go more than, say, 2-3 games without a goal, I get a haircut. Makes no sense.
Yeah.
Except that it's amazing how many times it worked. And it probably kicks out the negative vibes that you've got in your head. So even though it's super silly, if I play a match, if I scored in the first half, I'd keep the same shirt on. If I didn't, I'd change the shirt at halftime.
Right.
There's all sorts of nonsense in here. But it's just, again, it's like something fresh, something just different thinking. Yeah. At the time, I didn't think of it as that way. But the more I reflect on it now, because it's a bit embarrassing, really, all these silly things that you do. I'd drive a certain route if it was going well, and then I'd try somewhere else if it wasn't, and all these stupid things on the way to the game. Rio said, I used to, the water bottles.
Yeah.
He said, you had to empty it on his head before he went out. I mean, It's all sorts of nonsense. But ridiculous. If it works.
Yeah.
But did you keep them right to the end of your career, those sessions?
Yeah. 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 I'm ashamed to say.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
I'm so interested in this conversation about, you talk almost like it happened to you rather than you made this happen.
Yeah, I think they're both true. You know, you've got to make it happen, but I'm also aware that I was given a talent. I got a talent, born with a talent that, you know, so you can't just go to someone, you know, some kid playing football who's not got that talent and, you know, say, if you work hard enough, you're going to go all the way to the top. You know, if you work hard enough, you'll get to the best level that you can possibly get. And that's, I think that's as much as you can say to someone in that sense.
But I think there is an important conversation to have here that even with all that talent, you're doing yourself a disservice if you don't talk to us about the hard work that had to go with it. So did you make a conscious decision at one point to be the hardest worker in the room? You mentioned earlier on that
I don't think I was the hardest worker in the room in terms of training and stuff like that. I didn't really enjoy training because I didn't think it ever was that helpful. Apart from, I didn't mind the working out, you know, the pre-season, getting fit, which was important. But I used to get really kind of frustrated by how training used to be then. And I know it's changed a lot now. You know, you play on bumpy pitches. And all I wanted to do was practice my craft, which was, you know, making runs, scoring goals, getting into dangerous areas. Whereas most of the training was five-a-sides with little goals, and it used to bore me and didn't stimulate me. And I used to think what was it giving us? Especially strikers. You finish it in a goal that's really small, and then how does that help? So I never really loved training, but I used to think a lot about the game. And I think most of my training was off the training ground, off the pitch. And I loved working with Terry Venables. When we were in Barcelona, we used to go to lunch two or three times a week, which you'd never normally do with a coach, never. But probably because he was the English guy there and I was with Mark Hughes, and we'd go for lunch to the beach club or sometimes, and we'd just discuss football and movement. And he was the coach that was so different, because I played for lots of really good coaches and there are loads around, but it was always, this is the way the team plays. There's a structure, there's a way, this is how you play within it. But with Terry, he'd come to me two or three times a week. So I've been thinking about this, you know, if the ball's there on the right-hand side, and if you just check maybe to the left and then spin out to the right, do you think that would work? And sometimes I'd go, not really, Terry. But then, and then other times I'd say, maybe. And then we'd try it. And then every now and again, there'd be something you go, I actually do that. And I loved that. For me, the work, which I didn't find it as work, was thinking about the game, thinking about how to get better, But for me, training was always a disappointment, you know, and I wanted to do shooting. And then on the days we'd do shooting, everybody did it. So you got like 20 players, guy knocking the ball to the coach, getting one back. You get a shot every 10 minutes. But it was only in the latter stages in my career where I was confident enough to go to a coach, which was Terry. Not when I was at Barcelona, because, you know, in Barcelona, they only had one tiny pitch as a training ground, right next to the stadium.
The one at the stadium.
It's obviously magnificent now. But when I went to Tottenham, I used to say to him, is it all right if I go on my own with a goalkeeper and a bag of balls and someone to knock the ball? And he was fine. He went, yeah, you do that. And then I actually felt I was getting something out of it. That's, I want to practice what I do on the pitch. Yeah. I don't want to stand there and be part of a team working on team shape where you don't do anything for an hour and a half. And it just bored me.
I want to move the conversation on to something a bit different. You've said that you felt really blessed, and you can't almost believe that this is the life that happened to you. And if you don't want to discuss this, then that's absolutely fine. But there's probably the two moments that would not make you feel like you've been blessed is the two separations that you've had. We have a lot of people that listen to this and talk to us about relationships in the workplace with partners, with their children quite often. Would you mind sharing us that in this wonderful life of abundance and being so blessed and achieving so much, what those quite difficult personal journeys have taught you?
I don't see them as that. I see them as two really, really successful marriages.
Right.
I had 20 years with Michelle. We, as people do, we married young. We, and after a long period of time, we just drifted slightly apart, made a decision to go on our own. I think that was a really good marriage. And my second marriage with Danielle, that was purely a thing about children and change. And I mean, obviously there are ups and downs in all marriages anyway. And then breakups, you know, it's actually getting around to doing it. The difficulty is the actual procedure of the divorce thing in this country, which is, has been absurd. And I think it's going to be changed, where somebody has to take the blame for a failed marriage, which was ludicrous. And I think that's actually going
to change. That's an interesting way to look at those divorces though, because we speak sometimes about manifestation on this podcast, which basically means if you operate with a high energy, high positive energy, good things happen to you. And some people would have looked at those two and said, well, I was married for 20 years and it failed. What a shame. Or I had a great relationship that was at the beginning and it didn't go anywhere. That's, but yeah, you choose to look at the positives. And I wonder whether that's the reason why good things have happened to you throughout your life, because this is the power of looking on the positive side. Yeah.
Well, I am a positive. I've always been a positive person. I think I'm sure it's probably helped me in many ways. No question about that. But that's how I genuinely feel. I'm friendly with both my ex-wives and you said if you could do it all again, would you? Yes. I wouldn't change a thing. I got four wonderful boys with Michelle and a best mate with Danielle.
Can you offer us some advice on how you maintain those friendships, even while like the romantic element might fizzle away, that people listening to this, even if it's not about personal relationships, it might be about in the workplace.
Yeah. I can only go on my own experiences, and that's, you know, and I'm someone who doesn't like confrontation for a start. So I'll do everything I can. It's in my nature to try and make everything okay. And that's important. I think the difficult thing in divorce is that what happens is if it's because someone else has been involved, then that becomes a difficult experience. I don't know what that's like. So from my experience, it was more of, you know, just let's do it. And then the difficult bit is dealing with the media side of it, who is, it suddenly becomes this massively negative story,
right,
when it doesn't necessarily need to be that. And the other difficult thing is when lawyers get involved, because, and people who've been through this will know exactly what I'm talking about. You know, you can go perhaps with hoping to have a nice amicable split, and then the divorce lawyers get in and the letters go out, and then you start to think, oh, she doesn't like me, or, you know, and then, and basically they're just trying to make money for themselves. You know, and that's with the first divorce, I learned a lot from that, because, you know, I think we were exploited. And I think, my second divorce cost, I think, lawyers' fees was 500, 600 quid, because we did it online. Right. And you can do it because it's amicable. And that would be my best advice. Try and make your split as amicable as possible, because it's so much better and it's so much less stressful. And that's important, because dealing with stress is not fun for anyone.
I love your positive outlook. I love that you look on the good side. So how does that sit in this modern world where every time someone puts up a tweet, overcomes the criticism, you know, people with 100% of an opinion with only 10% of the knowledge about either you or what you've said. And we've all been there where we put things up and we feel almost bullied into deleting them because it's just not worth the heat. What's your relationship like with this modern world?
I don't get affected by it. You know, I put my opinions up and saying, and if people disagree. If they get abusive, then I...
How do you not get affected by it? Because so many people do.
I don't really get affected because I don't read it. You know, on Twitter, you get there's different columns. There's the bit where you get people that I follow. So, you know, and blue tick holders. And then there's another column of it with people just reply. I never look at the left-hand column ever, because... Why would you?
But you obviously have done to make the decision not to.
Well, I've seen it, but yeah. And I see and from other think people. You do? And what things do people have a go at me about? They'll talk about football and stuff, but really, everyone's got an opinion on football. Why would you ever get upset by somebody disagreeing with you on a football opinion? On things like refugees, for example, where I'm hugely supportive of humanitarian issues and I will continue to be so, I just can't really comprehend how you cannot have a degree of empathy towards people having to flee their own country, which is an unimaginable thing to have to do. I mean, you imagine if suddenly London was completely bombed like we're seeing in Ukraine now and we all had to go. I think you've got to think like that a little bit. So I've always been, on that side of things. And anyone who wants to have a pop at me about that, I don't think they're worth the time of day. That's my personal opinion. So why would I let it affect me? Also, don't forget, if you growing up as a footballer, you get dox abuse, even from the crowd, if you've got your name being sung by, 10,000 fans when you're away from home singing, Gary Lineker, you're a wanker, which I had numerous times, but I always took that as a compliment because if the opposition fans are singing songs about you, they must be worried about you. So I think it's probably something that I've got used to over the years, but I've always avoided really reading the negative stuff. Sometimes I put tweets out just to do something ridiculously sarcastic and then have a look to see if anyone actually believes I really thought that. But again, that's my mentality. But it was like when I played football, I didn't want to see negativity. And people say, it's like now, if you're on social media now as a footballer, it's a different thing. But in a similar way, when I played, if I'd scored two goals or a hat trick or something on the Saturday, I'd buy every Sunday newspaper.
Would you?
Yeah. And Monday newspaper. If I hadn't scored, never buy a newspaper. So it's a similar thing. It's obviously different because it's social media and it's all encompassing, but it's a similar mindset.
But how much is integrity important for you? And the reason I ask that is that I remember like your last game in English football was at United and you got a standing ovation, didn't you, at the end?
It was beautiful. That's one of the reasons that I've always had a degree of affinity towards.
Yeah, towards I remember being with my brothers, and I think part of the reason, because I remember even at the time when you came off the field and we sort of reflected on why you got it, and I think it was because you'd acted throughout your career with integrity, and I think that was what people were recognising.
I think it's important. I really do, especially in modern times. There's a lot of hate out there now. I mean, we've always been tribal creatures, but I think, with social media and things, it's become more so. And why can't you have a different opinion to someone, whatever it is, even if it, why does it have to be so divisive? And I think sometimes, games are played with us in this country to make us more divisive. And I think that's really dangerous. And I think we're seeing it more and more. And I think that's a terrible shame.
What do you mean by that?
I mean by stoking the fire. Like take Brexit, for example, which I don't talk about anymore. And I don't because it's done and we're on this course that I didn't agree with at the time. So, we'll see where it leads us. But it was like, you're either a Brexit or a Remainer or a Ramona. Why? Two or three friends of mine are Remainers. Two or three friends of mine were Brexiteers, if you want to use those words.
Yeah.
Do we not get on back? Because of it? No, we're still best. It doesn't make any difference just because you have slightly different beliefs about something. But I think there's this thing where whether it's through the newspapers, where they're constant front page, having a go at the other side. And it's all become like really nasty. And I can't comprehend that. I just don't have that it's just really weird.
Life used
you
to be about.
You sit right at the top of the government.
100%. Because right they stand the against things now. Life used to be, what do you stand for?
Yeah.
Now it's all about what do you stand against?
Yeah.
And we see it, you're totally right, from the very top of government, it's about what they disagree with rather than what they actually have as their own policies. And what should we all be doing to live in a world with less anger and less polarisation and less disagreement? Could we all be doing a better job ourselves?
Well, we could, but wouldn't it be lovely to find a way of actually doing that? I have no idea how we do that. I don't have a go at anyone on Twitter and stuff. Even if I disagree with them, I might do a little joke or something, if they particularly deserve it or something. But don't be nasty. Why, you know, why do people feel the need to be unkind and horrible to other people? You wouldn't do it to their face.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, it's a social media thing. There's a lot of good about social media, you know, a lot of good. You know, you see a lot of really positive things, but that downside, it just seems to have, you know, be kind of divided us more and more. That them and us thing, which is wrong.
So beyond acting with integrity and just representing your views, and why shouldn't you share those views? And like you say, the stuff about empathy, you struggle not to. Are you ever tempted just not to have an opinion because you know the flack or the response would be?
If I feel strongly about something, what's the point of having the platform that I've, you know, enormous platform that I've got, if I don't try and lose it for what I think is good and what I think is important? I might be wrong on some things. We're all wrong about some things.
So if you could boil down, what would you regard as the important message you'd want people that go onto your platform to take away and do differently?
Just it's fine to disagree. It's fine to disagree. It's fine to debate. It's absolutely fine.
Yep.
But when you become abusive and nasty and unkind and personal, that's unacceptable. And think to yourself, why am I doing this? Is it just clickbait? Is it just some kid in a thing? And then you think, well, why would I care about what he thinks anyway at this stage of his life? But I think that's the downside of social media that you get.
And what about your children? What do they what do they think of it? Because they must get, they're more of an age where they've probably grown up.
George gets blamed, but George is very, very phlegmatic. George is quite witty, and he deals with people in his own way. Nothing gets to him. I mean, I don't know if it's because what he went through when he was a baby, but he had leukemia and stuff, but he can't remember it. But I don't know whether he's had a knock on anything else. Doesn't seem to matter. But he deals with it very well. He's the only one really that's, they're all on Twitter, but none of them really bother and get, he tweets a lot, and he's got a decent following because he's actually quite funny, and he's very self-deprecating. So, and I think that always works. A bit of fun at your own expense sometimes, but yeah, so they're okay. They're all quite relaxed about social media. They don't, you know, if they get a bit of stick, that doesn't seem to bother them, which is the right way.
Well, how do they handle it when they see the dad getting stick?
They're quite, you know, protective, like anyone else. It's very protective. But they know it doesn't bother me.
Right.
They know, you know. And sometimes I might say, this idiot had a, you know, saying this, and then, you know, on one of, we've had WhatsApp group chats and stuff. Oh, did you see that? But he's an idiot, dad, and all that, you know. So you'll get a bit of supportive stuff like that, and I'll go, don't worry.
Yeah. It's nice. I think part of the problem is the medium as well, though, isn't it? That it's not face-to-face conversation.
That's exactly it. We all get a bit of stick sometimes for something on Twitter or what.
Try doing but your job having not played
street,
professional football.
On the street, when did you ever get any stick?
Never.
Never.
But do you remember when I joined BT and I wrote that blog about we're going to have new pundits fresh from the game? And you took offence to that, and you messaged me and said you've offended people with a lifetime in the game.
Well, yeah.
And like, that bothered me, obviously, because you're Gary Lineker and I was like a young guy in his 20s trying to make his mark in the industry. And that, I think, is a good example. If we'd had that conversation, I'd have said, oh, yeah, we're going to get some fresh guys because I think it's going to be really good. There was never any offence meant, but because it was a written post.
Yeah, because it came over as though you were having a pop at these guys that I've worked with for years. So it's like anyone, if someone's critical of me or something like that, I don't care. But it's also that thing, isn't it? It's like with your kids, for example. When I've got four boys, and there's loads of times I've had to dish out, like telling off, and you discipline them in whatever way you can. But the minute someone else outside has a go at your kids, the protective side. What? What do you mean? And then you don't like it, do you? And it was only that, Jake. It was, you know.
But that's an example of why the world's so hard, because I didn't obviously mention your pundits, but interpretation.
Yeah.
And that's the issue. We now live in a world where you will interpret a tweet from someone very differently to you, differently to me. Mm. We need to find a way.
Well, it's hard.
Having
the nuance
more empathy
with words.
You know, correct.
We've all done it with text messaging to people before even social media came along, haven't we? Where people have got the wrong end of the wrong end.
I'm all about the voice note now, because I think if you voice note people on WhatsApp, then your voice.
I get halfway through and then think, what was I going to say?
Before we wrap this up, I do want to talk to you about moving into television and the importance of Des Lynam, who I know, as you know, is a hero of mine. And I want people to understand the importance of generosity of spirit in this world.
He called me a month ago.
How is he?
I haven't seen him for quite a long time. He sounded great.
What did he do for you when you first came into this industry?
He did a hell of a lot. And obviously, when I first came in, I sat next to him as a pundit for a couple of years while I did a bit of radio and tried to, you know, as you well know, there are no kind of facilities to practice television, live television. If you're doing live television, it's you go straight into the deep end. And my deep end was the highlights of the 1996 Euros. And my second show was England Scotland's highlights, and I think we had like eight, nine million people watching it or something stupid. So and it was kind of in at the deep end. But Des was always, always really amazingly supportive. But at the same time, I would push Des and ask him loads of questions about, because I was with I think is the doyen of sports presenters. And he was always incredibly helpful. And there were loads of things I noticed that he would do. I remember, I mean, I've said this before, but if he used to look at the auto queue and stuff, and he'd say, "I'm joining us this evening," blah 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 blah, and they were joining us. And I did this all season, and I remember it was once written on his screen as saying, "And joining me this evening," I heard him say to the auto queue, "Can you take me off and just put us, please?" So I said to him, "I've noticed that, but you always say us." And I said, "Why do you do that?" And he said, "Well, you've got to remember this show is not me. It's about everybody involved, everybody that's watching at home. It's a thing that we do all together." So I've never said joining me. Oh, I may have done if it was a mistake, yeah. But I've all, you know, joining it just, and there were lots of little things. And he used to say, he said they're all terribly good. They're very good. He said, but they don't take chances. They don't try and have a bit of fun with something. You know, don't take it too serious. Try and think of a fun closing line. He said, sometimes it will be rubbish. But people will notice, and it'll be more impactful. And they were the things that I took on board, and I've used right throughout my television career. And I've tried and be funny, and most of the time it's not.
But delivered it in a better way than Jock Wallace.
But it doesn't matter if you've got, you know, if you've got 3 million, 4 million, whatever is normally watch match of the day. If just a small percentage of those people laugh at one of your stupid jokes, then you've perhaps made someone smile. And that's important.
Really nice. Before we finish, we have our quick fire questions. What would you say, Gary, are your three non-negotiable behaviours that you and the people around you need to buy into?
I think kindness. I think that's really, really important. Self-awareness. I think it's very important, which gives you an understanding of caring for people as well, which is I think an important thing. And a third one, I think the third one is have some fun. You know, have fun with life. We only get one go.
If you could go back to it one moment in time, what would it be and why?
That's a good question. 1990. World Cup semi-final. Probably not the penalty shootout, but probably Chris Waddle's shot when it goes across the goal, hits the inside of the post. See, now I know which way it would come out. So I would have moved myself a couple of yards to the side and knocked it in and went 1-2-1. And that's the only football match in my whole career where I look back and think, if only. I know there's the Brazil penalty thing, but that, you know, that's just a personal goal. But being that close to a World Cup final, that, you know, to lose on a penalty shootout, or to be a whisker of the wrong side of the post when it hit Chris Waddle's ball, came back out. And I honestly believe we'd have won the final. Obviously, I don't know that, but, you know, they weren't the same Argentinian side that we'd played 4 years previously. And that would have meant we were 90 minutes away from football immortality. And that's the only thing. And Bobby Robson was exactly the same. I had the conversation with him. It was the only thing that he ever used to bank. So not every day. I don't think about it all the time, honest. But every now and again, you just think, God, if only.
What would you say is your highest performance moment? And what is the time where you feel you really let yourself down?
Highest performance moment, I think it has to be the winning the Golden Boot. Probably the hat-trick against Poland, because it changed my life. It changed my life. It put me right at the top. You know, before that, I think I'd gone 5 or 6 games without a goal with England. I expected to be dropped for that game because we'd had bad results in the first two and we needed to win the game and I hadn't scored, even though I'd gone close. I thought Bobby would leave me out, but he didn't. He left Mark Hatley out for the first time ever. I think England played two small strikers and Beardsley played just off me and it worked. And I scored three goals in the first half and then I got two in the next game and then one against Argentina. I've got the goal in the Argentinian game that no one remembers. And then I'm sat with a golden boot and life was different. I was off to Barcelona and everything was different in my life. So it has to be that.
And the time where you feel you most let yourself down?
On the football pitch, probably that moment with my dad.
Yeah.
When he dragged me off the pitch. But realistic, in the football sense, probably that silly penalty against Brazil in a way. It was only friendly, but I was just being trying to be clever. You know, so I'll do it in style with a little Panenka. And that came off wrong.
And in a non-football sense?
Non-football, I'm trying to think. A non-football, I've done things that I wish I hadn't really got involved with the Brexit thing.
Really?
To be honest, I don't mind admitting, you know, not the sense of putting out that I was going to vote for Remain, because I don't mind putting out what I do, but the thing afterwards and then getting a bit carried away with the fact that we lost, and I think if I had my time again, I wouldn't have bothered with that.
What's been the biggest sacrifice you've made in your pursuit of high performance, and would you do it again?
I think all the sacrifices I made, I don't think they're that great.
Maybe you feel too blessed to see them.
That's what I mean. What a life I've had. Training hard, or thinking about the game all the time, or going to TV and media. And I mean, I feel I've had such an incredibly fortunate life and such a lovely balance to my life that I don't consider anything that I've done as a sacrifice.
Brilliant. And the final question, and this is kind of your last message to the people that have sat and listened to this conversation, which I've really loved, by the way. How would you describe your one golden rule to living a high performance life?
Yeah. Give yourself the best chance to succeed. Work as hard as you possibly can. Do everything that you possibly can and just aim high. And then you'll reach that level that then you'll be satisfied with yourself. And that's the most important thing. If you know you've done as well as you possibly can, then I think you can be satisfied.
Damien.
Jake.
I really want people to listen to that conversation with Gary and realise that sometimes there isn't loads and loads of thought that goes into someone's high-performance life. And actually, when you are a high performer, the reality is that sometimes it does feel like you're on someone else's roller coaster ride and you're being carried along and taken along with it. But I think the key thing with Gary is that he has such a positive outlook on life. And we've had these conversations so many times on high performance. If you have a positive outlook, if you see the good in every situation, if you believe that great things are going to happen, more often than not, they do.
Yeah, definitely. I think the big thing that I took away from what Gary was talking about in his career was just sometimes put one foot in front of another. Don't get blinded by thinking I need to get to a certain level. You know, he said that he was 24 when he eventually made his England debut, which was relatively late for it. But he wasn't missing any of the steps of the process out. He was following the process of going from being an apprentice to a young professional to establishing himself at Leicester. And it's almost that willingness to wait and to be patient in your pursuit of high performance and trying to rush it and get there too soon.
And even though he likes to look at the positives, you know, let's talk about the fact that, you know, he was embarrassed by his dad on a football field at a young age. He was a late developer, which also embarrassed him in front of his peers. He had a really challenging manager, Jock Wallace, at Leicester. He had really low points on a football field. You know, he's been central to a game of football, which has taken this country so close to a World Cup that they didn't win. He's then had times where he's been pilloried on social media and kind of been forced to delete things that he's tweeted, for example. All of those things have happened to him, but he still chooses to see his life as blessed and positive and wonderful. And I think there's a real value in realizing that those moments that are hard are not necessarily negative moments in our lives. They're all part of the story. And you can, in almost every situation, you can find the positive at the end of it.
Yeah. And if there's a message that people listening to this could take away, it's about that very word, gratitude. It's about practicing gratitude, which is what we're hearing Gary talk about. He's not just grateful when things go well. He's grateful for when they don't go well. He still practices that gratitude, which then gives you that spirit of abundance, that gives you the capacity to be kind, which attracts people of a similar mindset into your world. But if you want a starting point, it's about having that attitude of gratitude.
Love that. Prioritize empathy over opinion. How many times have we said that on this podcast?
We hear it so often that it's not by chance. It's the ability to step into somebody else's world, see it from their perspective, and just suspend your own ego is such an important characteristic.
Loved it. Thanks, mate.
Thank you, mate.
Right, time to meet another high-performance listener. And I've actually met this person before because many of you know we did a live tour in the back end of 2021, the start of 2022, and the final date was at the O2. And as I was leaving, someone came up and chatted to me and told me the story. And I think you should hear the story as well because he's since reached out to us. He'd love to come on the podcast and share his message with you. So welcome the man who has created Gin Barnard, which... And I'm not being paid to say this. He kindly sent me a bottle and it was absolutely delicious. Hey, Ben, how are you?
Very well, thank you very much. How are you guys?
We're really well, thanks. Really well. Now, just to explain the way this works for people. So we record these over Zoom and we give you a time. You come on and we have a quick chat. Just before we started recording, though, we said, hi, Ben, thanks for being with us. And you said, yeah, thanks, guys. I'm doing the classic entrepreneurs thing today. I'm trying to balance my business and my home life and my work life and everything else. So would you mind just explaining to people at home what today looks like for you? Because we have lots of wannabe entrepreneurs who see the glamour and the glitz and the fun and the nice cars and the exit valuation and all those things. Like, what's the truth?
So today, yes, we all have those dreams. Today looked very much like no car. Car is in the garage at the moment. My son is at a district athletics meet in the rain. And I have to be here as well. I'm a big fan of sport, so I follow him as much as I can. So I bought the laptop, and he is an avid listener as well. And he's mentioned that he would like to miss his meet and come and do this as well. I was like, no, you go and do what you need to do, and I'll do what I need to do. And you can listen back in the weeks to come when it comes out. But yes, it's been manic. Up at 5, quick workout. Breakfast, get him to school, find a taxi that will bring me to the place because I've got no car today, answer a few emails, answer a few phone calls, organise his him and some of his mates because they've lost where they're meant to meet on the track. So it's been all go. All very much exciting. And in the pouring rain, hence why I probably look like a drowned rat on camera today.
Well, it's all in the glamorous life of an entrepreneur. So talk to us then about what high performance has done for you and why you think it's done what it has done.
For me, it's allowed me to become more disciplined. I've listened to every single one that you guys have done. It's helped me in a time where I was perhaps slightly coming off rails, not really sure what I was meant to do, lost a bit of direction. And I think a lot of us sit there and think we are the only ones. You know, there's no one else in the world that will think like me. I must be crazy. I must be doing something wrong. And it is nice to hear. And I like most of my friends are heavily into football. So I have listened to every single one, but I actually missed the Rio Ferdinand one on purpose because I've grown up playing football. And I started to look for my knowledge with people I didn't know. People that you have on the podcast, I thought, I don't know who this is. You know, like, but I will listen. So it's nice for me to be able to relate to people that have been through my journey, and it kind of allows me to sort of stay a little bit more central, stay on point, and think, well, if I keep going this way, something's going to happen.
So what you're describing there then, Ben, is almost the power of cognitive diversity, having conflicting views that come in. So who is it that's really challenged your thinking, one of the guests on the podcast, that has led to a breakthrough of thought for you?
There's Rio Ferdinand, who said many things, doing different things. I grew up doing different things to my friends. So whereas Rio did the ballet and the dance, and he kind of had to sneak away from his sort of peers, I did drama and sang and, you know, performed. And not that my friends didn't necessarily know, but it wasn't kind of the norm. I was meant to be that jock who was in all the sports teams and did et cetera, et cetera. So he really spoke to me about doing different things. And you've got huge guests and sort of a plethora of people are coming to my head. But Ben Francis, he, you know, although he's a lot younger than I am, man, what he does is just brilliant. It's just, it's, you know, he's just on this wave and he's, and his product is quality. And he's allowed me to, with our product, we are trying to create a product that's quality and not quantity. So those two guys specifically, I've related to them quite a lot.
And can you explain to us whether you focus on process or outcome? Because obviously, you know, it's easy for you, I think, in some ways to look at a gin manufacturer or a spirits manufacturer who is in a place where you'd love to be in the future. But actually, the only thing for you to do is look at yourself and look at your daily tasks and the world-class basics that you employ. So where do you sit, Ben, on this process versus outcome conversation?
Everything is about process to me. I truly do believe in the process, and it is something that my current, you know, boy who's out there running at the moment is, he's just failed a discus. He didn't get a throw. He's just won the 200 meters. And it's about the process. It's getting yourself ready, doing those basics every day. We have a chart at home that we use.
What's on the chart?
So the chart is about input and output. I talked to him about what we can input into our lives that will allow us to get a percent output. So I spoke to him about the 1% increase. And he, his first conversation was with me, well, Dad, why would I put 1% extra in? Or why would I want to get 1% extra in if I can get 10% more? Because I said, well, you do your 10% that 1 week. I'll do my 1% every day. And let's at Christmas time, at the end of the year, see who's got more percentage increase. Mine should be 365. Yours might be 30, 40. And really talking to him about what he can control. He can control his sleep. He can control his eating. He can control everything within his realm of life. What he can't control is what others do. You know, his bus was late to the event today. So he came off, chucked his bag to me, ran to the discus, hit three no throws, but dusted himself down, picks himself back up, wins the 200.
Brilliant.
Wonderful. Well, listen, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you very much for sharing that message. And just keep on driving hard. It's a real pleasure to see you again. Thanks for coming to the live tour. And I'm so pleased that we've had a positive impact for you. Right, that's just about it for us. Florence has long wanted to follow in my footsteps and be a podcast presenter. So she's asked if she can read the outro for today. So I've written it down for her. Off you go, Flo.
As always, a huge thanks goes to you for growing and sharing this podcast among you. Community, please continue to spread the learnings you're taking from this series. Thanks to Finn from
Rethink.
To Rethink this audio. Hannah, Will, Eve and Gemma, remember there is no secret. It is all there for you. So chase the world.
Chase world.
Chase world-class basics. Don't get high on your own supply. Remain humble, curious, and empathetic.
Empathetic.
And we'll see you very soon.
Thank you very much, Florence. There you go. A reading lesson as well as a podcast today. And everything Flo's just said, we absolutely mean. Listen, can I just say one final thing? Please, 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 for free, join the High Performance Circle. There are tens of thousands of members. They're getting keynote speeches. They're getting high performance boosts. They're getting newsletters. They're getting content and information that is changing their lives on a weekly basis. So if you'd like to join the High Performance Circle, just go to thehighperformancepodcast.com, click on Circle. It's all there for you.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.